You are listening to the Effective Statistician Podcast, the weekly podcast with Alexander Schacht and Benjamin Pieske, designed to help you reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients without becoming overwhelmed by work. Today, I'm talking with Paolo. He is listening to this podcast from the very beginning. He's one of the first listeners that I had more contact to and that also gave me some feedback about the podcast. And there were a lot of further development beyond that that you will learn about in this podcast episode. We speak about a really important topic. We talk about how to display uncertainty in your visualizations. This is really, really important so that others can make good decisions and have a good understanding of how much variability there is or how much precision there is. So stay tuned. And now the music. I heard there are still many out there that are not on LinkedIn, which I cannot completely understand. I know these kind of social media can be distracting and they maybe are something that people feel will, you know, create a lot of work or just, you know, waste a lot of time. But I think LinkedIn is a really exception because you'll not find just a lot of, you know, fancy stuff there or boring stuff like yet another cat video, but you get a lot of really, really good content and you also can grow your network. And there's lots of opportunities in terms of collaboration, in terms of new jobs, in terms of, you know, getting more exposure out there. So depending on whether you want to just kind of see who's out there or whether you want to actually be part of the, let's say, content producing community, get over to LinkedIn and if you're then there, then follow me and you'll get much more content from my side there as well. So head over to LinkedIn and sign up and connect to me. That would be very, very valuable. I'm producing this podcast in association with PSI, community dedicated to leading and promoting the use of statistics within the healthcare industry for the benefit of patients. Join PSI today to further develop your statistical capabilities with access to the video on demand content library, free registration to all the PSI webinars, and much, much more. Visit the PSI website at psiweb.org to learn more about PSI activities and become a PSI member today. Welcome to another episode, and today I'm talking to Paolo, who is a long-term listener of this podcast. And actually, we met through this podcast because as a listener, he contacted me at some time, and as he was thinking about moving outside of his current position, and whether it would be a good idea to move into the pharma industry. And that was a really, really great start for more longer-term collaboration. And now we are working together on a daily basis, which is really good. So, Paolo, but maybe you can, you know, explain a little bit about yourself, about your career.
Thanks, Alexander. It's really a pleasure to be here. So I think that I'm quite addicted to podcasts in general. And I should say that the Effective Statistician podcast is my favorite one. And we met through this podcast. And I was quite surprised that in the beginning, Alexander asked me for some feedback, how to improve episodes or what interesting topics could be covered. So it was quite interesting approach to ask for feedback for listeners. So I'm Paolo Eusebi. I'm based in Italy, in a beautiful region in the middle of Italy, which is Umbria. I spent almost the entire my career in academia and the public sector until 2019. I have mainly worked with neurology area and other therapeutic area. I provided the support to regulatory authorities and regional government bodies, trying to keep our healthcare systems organized and providing the right treatments for our patients. I was also involved in many research projects, and mainly in the neurological field, mainly on biomarkers. So finding, for example, the best biomarkers for the diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease, investigating the utility of these biomarkers as inclusion criteria for clinical trials, or maybe as a diagnostic tool in clinical practice for providing early diagnosis to people with Alzheimer's disease. And I've been also interested in meta-analysis, both interventional and diagnostic ones. And I was quite involved in the activities of the Cochrane collaboration at international and national level. And then I've been also interested in meta-research activities in terms of investigating how different kind of research provide support to decision makers or patients. If it's better to have intention to treat or modified intention to treat in clinical trials, and this kind of stuff.
Today actually we talk also a little bit about meta research in some way, because we are talking about how can we best display uncertainty. And so usually there's a lot of data that we provide, and the general public, I think, thinks a lot in terms of means and proportions and things like this. But of course, we know that all of these things are not certain. Actually, the opposite. There's always some uncertainty on all the data that we get. And so, of course, we are not as researchers, we are not the only ones that deal with these uncertainty. You've looked into a couple of examples that is more used in the in the public press in terms of displaying uncertainty. So what kind of examples of displaying uncertainty have you found there?
I think that we have many examples from areas in which it's quite crucial to provide sensible information to large public, like weather forecast or polls for a presidential election in United States, for example. So it's quite crucial to deliver a message to the people. And so people working in the models behind this message know that there is uncertainty in the data and in the final estimates, and it's quite crucial to provide this uncertainty in the message. Like it's quite a famous example, the New York Times needle for the election of the President of the United States in 2016. So we have a quite popular graphical display, like a gauge plot, Mm-hmm. And you have this needle just running in the different portion of the gauge plot, showing if the chance of winning the presidency for this candidate is likely or very likely, or toss up maybe. And you have this needle moving quite fast between the 25th and 75th percentile.
Yeah.
So it's quite a nice display showing that, these are the data, but, things are not certain.
Yeah. It gives kind of a good feeling because, you get over time, with this animated version of displaying uncertainty, a feeling that, there's instability. So directly when you're looking at it, you directly get this feeling of instability. Like if you're looking at any kind of measurement that is kind of moving all the way, like if you have, for example, a scale or something like this, and it's moving a little bit upwards and downwards all the times, and it's not super precise. And here with the polls, then you also see and directly get that impression. And you cannot even, pinpoint what's the average here. Yeah. So you see, it's about there. Yeah. But you cannot really say, the average poll result tells me it will be, 52% versus 48% in favor of this person. Yeah, and so that's an interesting way. What else did you find?
Yeah, also in terms of politics, the Trump's approval tracker from 538, mm-hmm. Which is a blog covering mainly sport and politics issues, and it's quite nice that this. Approval tracker shows the confidence bands surrounding the point estimates of this simple question. So, if you agree or disagree with the presidential actions, and you have also predictions, and there is a nice way to cover predictions, which is lightening a bit the areas and putting a dashed line instead of a solid line for the estimate. Yeah. And you see that it's future, so it's less certain that the story behind us. So
yeah, so it's really nice because you can both see kind of the history and how it's kind of variable over time. So that's one point in terms of variability. Then the other point is kind of at a given time point, the uncertainty with the confidence bands. And then, that you see from up to today and then beyond, you see also another differentiation in terms of how uncertainty is displayed differently, and that the uncertainty increases with time moving into the future. Where I always kind of struggle a little bit is with these bands or the confidence intervals that we sometimes see, because I think it doesn't show so nicely the distribution. Yeah, so it's, of course, if you think of a distribution function, the probability close to the point estimate is it's much bigger than, to the end. And then it doesn't kind of go from 1 to 0. like these bands kind of suggest, but it's it moves gradually to zero. So that's one of the things that I don't so much like about confidence intervals. It's at least some way to go feeling, give some feeling for it. The other point is, of course, sometimes it gets confused in terms of what is the population variation and what is the variability of the estimate.
Yeah.
So these are basically two uncertainties. And I think sometimes people mix it up quite easily and confuse these two topics.
Yeah. Of course, if you have, a BMI from United States and BMI from Europe, and you mix up the two populations, of course, your estimates have larger confidence intervals, but there's nothing to do with the BMI. It's all about the different populations involved. Yeah. And we have quite large problems in conveying the message effectively to people with this kind of confidence bands, because our brain is hardwired to get suddenly an overall picture of phenomena. So it's trying to get the holistic picture of what's happening, and maybe can perceive that all the confidence bands are equally likely, or maybe that outside these confidence bands, nothing is possible.
Yeah.
Two different, mistakes we can do.
So there's another example that you found about hurricane prediction. Yeah. And of course, I think we all know this kind of cone-like approach where you can see kind of where the hurricane may move over the next days. But I also have seen where people then show kind of a couple of different simulations of these actual moves of the hurricane. So you see kind of, let's say, from a simulation of 100 different, possible ways the hurricane can move, you can see each of these trajectories. What do you think about that approach?
I think that it's really nice. And of course, this is an active research area. And this is quite a solution compared to the cone of uncertainty approach. And it's quite nice because you can have the impression that the final outcome of a prediction depends on modeling assumptions, random sampling, algorithms, whatever, and we can have as many trajectories we want, and we can have these trajectories overlapping and giving us some gradient effect showing the likelihood of this track, but also the fact that one trajectory is possible, and we don't have whole area devastated by the hurricane in the end. Yeah. And it's nice because it's something that we can apply also in our biomedical research.
Yeah.
Because we can simulate different things, maybe different imputation scenarios for our longitudinal data, and see how the conclusions change according to different assumptions, or simply different samples resampling of the same data set.
Yeah, completely agree. But now you did also some meta research in terms of what's actually the current status in medical research. What did you do there?
We tried to provide simple approach, limiting our meta research field. So we picked up 700 records of published studies in top medical journals like JAMA, Annals of Internal Medicine, BMJ, New England Journal of Medicine, Lancet. And we did a random sampling of these 700 papers. We came up with 50 studies, and we analyzed how these studies display certainty. Mm-hmm. Of course, these studies are related to clinical studies findings. So there are no, you know, population studies, biomarker studies, or stuff like that, in order to have an homogeneous sample. And out of these 50 papers, only 39 papers showed the outcomes with plots, and only 14 papers displayed uncertainty in some way, you know, good or bad.
So that is actually already quite an interesting finding. Only about a third of the papers in these top journals have a visualization of uncertainty, which, you know, is blows my mind, to be honest.
Yeah.
It's you know, uncertainty is ingrained in all these studies. And it's really important to convey the uncertainty to make meaningful decisions based on these results. And it's not like, well, these are, you know, low-level journals, kind of throwaway journals that, you know, have no bigger impact. These are the best of the best, yeah? And so if it's even not, you know, well done in these areas, yeah, and we are not even speaking about well-done visualization, we are speaking about any visualization of uncertainty. Yeah, I think this can give us kind of probably some kind of upper boundary of what's overall happening in medical research. So what kind of uncertainty displays did you find there mostly?
Yeah, mostly quite, you know, common displays, like 95% confidence bands surrounding Kaplan-Meier curves, or some box plots, mm-hmm. or, you know, some line charts with, you know, showing the outcome by treatment over time. And we have this confidence bars surrounding the dots for each treatment and time point. And then some forest plot for subgroup analysis. Mm-hmm. And I think that maybe, you know, for some kind of ordinal outcomes, for example, like a modified ranking scale in stroke, maybe people is struggling with the right way to display uncertainty, because the usual approach is to draw stacked bar charts. You know, you have you have two treatments, and you have two stacked bar charts for the modified ranking scales at the end of the treatment period. So, but of course, times allow to you know, do a better work. So we have so it's not like the 70s. When yep. you have only black and white, and it's challenging to, you know, superimpose different time points or stuff like that. Now we can have big software, useful tools, and, you know, everything is possible. And it's quite surprising to see, you know, simple clustered bar charts in this top journal without, you know, any display of uncertainty. yeah. even on the top of these bars.
Yeah. So I think there's a lot of topics we can learn from, you know, what's happening, especially also outside of medical research. But yeah, I think starting also now within medical research to better display uncertainty. So for example, if we think about the, you know, simulated trajectories for the hurricanes, yeah, that would correspond to showing, you know, what happened to the individual patients within the treatments, yeah, and better showing these kind of things. I think, for example, Kaplan-Meier plots are basically already, you know, showing these more kind of individual patients. It's maybe not, you know, that people are really aware about it. But if you, for example, think about showing how patients move over time on a continuous scale, or, you know, your ranking scale, how would you do such an approach?
Yeah, I think that's it's quite an interesting question. I think we have animations. Mm-hmm. Since you can display each patient as a line or a circle floating in the space over time, and you can see maybe patient changing his color by according to the modified ranking scale level. And it's quite interesting because yesterday we did training session to people working in a patient-centered outcome research department. And there was quite a nice example from one of the people involved in this training, showing, you know, basically each patient as a circle. And, you know, you have this movement between different states. Mm-hmm. So you go from 0 to 1 or from 2 to 1, and you can see the bubble for each of each level. You see the bubble increasing or not, depending on the effectiveness of the treatment. So I think we can have many different approaches for showing uncertainty and showing the individual patient data beyond our results.
There's an interesting visualization that I saw one point at Flowing Data, this pretty famous visualization blog, where you can see what Americans do over the period of a day, yeah, so, and where they are in terms of sleep, work, leisure time, commuting, and things like this. And so there's a, you know, sample of Americans, each represented by a dot, and these different states are organized around a circle with different colors. And so the S people kind of move from one state to the next, they, you know, the dots change the color, and that is, you know, animated over 24 hours. And so you can basically see what's happening. Yeah, so when people start to get up, when people start to go to work, and all these kind of different things. Really, really nice display. And it shows what is the uncertainty? What is the variability of, you know, at a given time point as well as over the day? If we have something like these kind of categorical outcomes, that, yeah, is one potential to show it. And if it's kind of a ordinal categorical outcome, yeah, maybe it's not a circle, it's just you organize these kind of clusters along a line. And you can show two lines next to each other for two different treatments.
And you can have a Sankey diagram.
Or a Sankey diagram, yeah.
Which is perfect for the situation. Yeah, like, for instance, I did 2 weeks ago one basic Sankey diagram, showing the transition between different states in one scale. So it's quite nice and simple approach.
Yeah.
And it's quite communicative.
Yeah.
And I really don't understand why we are always trapped in our daily work with the same graphics we did, you know, from the dawn of statistics.
Line graphs and bar charts.
Yeah.
And Kaplan-Meier plots. And so it's, yeah, I completely agree. There's, you know, there's a lot of tools available. Yeah. I think when I talk to a lot of statisticians, the two biggest reasons for why, and actually we done a survey around that, is that the first is people are very busy with lots of other things, which for me tells me that's not important for them. Yeah, and I think it's so critical. You know, we spend millions and lots of time creating this data, and then, you know, at the last step where we communicate it, there we fail. Yeah. And so all the efforts that went into the design, the collection of the data, the analysis of the data, all this work then gets minimalized at the end. You know, it's like putting a Ferrari engine, you know, in a really, really nice car. And then the last steps that you need to do is put on tires, and you put on flat tires. It's kind of, yeah, it's, you know, it's completely wasted resources.
Yeah, of course, if you have a phase two study, then maybe you just need to get the message for, you know, continuing or not with a phase three trial and stuff like that. But we see the same problem also for phase four trials, for observational studies, for, you know, postdoc analysis, presentations for congresses or, you know, big medical conferences. Always the same approach, and communicating your results is critical and important. So it's not like you're saying, you know, something like fun and and amusement. Yeah, I completely agree.
Yeah. So there's a really good way to basically show the you know, patient level involvement. And that gives you a lot of better feelings. The other thing that helps so much there is that people actually see the individuals behind all this data. And I think that is a very, very powerful way to then tell a story. Yeah. And, you know, point at one of these dots and say, imagine this is, you know, a patient that you have in your clinic. Yeah, if you're talking to a physician, he kind of represents and is typical for the overall population, and see what happens to this person, yeah, and how it's reflected in the overall population. And that gives people a complete different, you know, emotional relationship to the data. And I think this is really important to learn from the data and to retain the data, because we know from neuroscience research that if we have an emotional connection to something, we are much better able to retain this knowledge. So this kind of storytelling about individuals is a powerful tool to communicate effectively.
Yeah, and this is why many interesting papers come from some cognitive specialist, like Leis Padilla, for instance, who is a specialist in cognition and neural science, because many of these visualization issues, including the uncertainty display, are quite related to how our brain works. So, and it's a matter of freeing up resources because we can see much better the overall picture, showing individual patient data, the estimates, the predictions, and stuff like that. And it's also about engaging the audience. Could be physicians, could be general public. But right now you have an interactive display. So everything is possible.
Yeah.
We can do it.
Yeah. And, you know, most of the journals accept these electronic appendices. So even if it doesn't cannot go into the main part, it can at least go into the appendix. Yeah. And for more kind of, for lots of, you know, usual electronic documents, you can, you know, have some kind of video or whatever embedded there. And even if that is not possible, yeah, you can find ways to have static display. So, for example, instead of having, you know, just confidence bands, you can, you know, have these bands colored in such a way that it reflects better the density around it. Yeah. And so there was recently a really nice display from Mark Bailey at one of the Wonderful Wednesdays, where he looked into four different Kaplan-Meier plots and then had small multiples for these four plots because they were quite close to each other. And then within these four different small multiples, he was showing the different confidence bands for these in such a way. So, you know, that at the that kind of the color fades out the more it is away from the average Kaplan-Meier plot. I think there's, you know, lots of opportunities. There is another opportunity that you have also included in slides that you presented recently at a PSI webinar, is where you show the how single patients basically change over time. And so in some kind of stacked line chart. And we'll link to these slides in the show notes. So that will give you, you know, a little bit of an impression when you have time watching them, because I know many of people listen to the podcast while driving or while running or while doing some other work. So when you're back in the office, you can have a look at the show notes and see kind of a couple of
iterations. Don't watch animations while you're driving.
So what are some good resources that you would recommend to display uncertainty in a better way?
A lot. I think that, for instance, the Alberto Cairo's book, The Trustful Art, has a lot of interesting material in terms of uncertainty display. Like the maybe the book of Klaus Wilke about fundamentals of data visualization, which is quite rich in terms of R code accompanying the book, but it's not a technical book. So you can read the book even if you don't want to code at all. And there is one chapter for visualizing uncertainty. And it's quite interesting because it's the, you know, the frequentist counterpart to the work that already done by the Northwestern University group.
Yeah.
So the people behind the Tidy Bayes R package. So then another important resource is the Moo Collective, directed by Jessica Allman and Matt Kay website.
Yeah, they're actually doing a lot of research on that.
Yeah.
So it's actually, you know, in terms of how people perceive uncertainty through different visualizations.
Yeah, and I think that the hypothetical outcome plot display comes from that lab.
Yeah.
And they are quite important people in the visualization research space. So, yeah.
And then, of course, we have the PSI Visualization Special Interest Group.
Yeah, it's really, really interesting because a lot of examples, I think that mainly in all of these interesting examples, there is a good coverage of the uncertainty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Okay, and the nice thing is, as you mentioned, there's a lot of, you know, R code out there. So that makes it really easy to implement lots of these different things. So it's not that you need to kind of start from scratch. There's lots of examples out there. And the also the special interest group on visualization is about to launch a homepage where you will see kind of examples, text around it in terms of what's good and bad about these different visualizations, as well as the example data sets and the example code. And that's an awesome opportunity to get some inspiration, but also some practical help for the implementation.
Yeah, it's very nice to see how different people take the same challenge with different approaches.
Yeah,
it's really inspiring.
Yeah, and for the visualization special interest group, this is of course not about hurricane data or, you know, it's about, you know, the usual medical data that we work on. And therefore, it's very specific and relevant for all the different things that we're doing.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks so much, Paolo. What was your main takeaway from working on uncertainty and displaying uncertainty?
Well, the main takeaway maybe is that we need to involve more our audience, physicians and patients in our daily work. So what we do is for patient public healthcare. There are a lot of different resources, a lot of different stuff we can do. But I think the main point is to try to convey the right message to the right people.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe we need to do more involvement of these people in what we do routinely.
Yeah, that's a really, really good point. Just because we as statisticians love tables because we want to see all the details doesn't imply that our audience also wants all the details.
Or maybe we get in love with complicated, overly complicated stuff just because are technically, you know, impressive.
Yeah.
But maybe it doesn't communicate anything to the general audience or physicians.
Yeah.
So we need a good balance.
Yeah. Yeah. Awesome. Thanks so much, Paolo. That was a great go through a couple of different topics in terms of what we can learn from lots of different examples out there in terms of displaying uncertainty. We started with the gauge chart that has this needle that is moving around, and we went through a couple of different other displays. We mentioned, you know, how you can show individual patients in the same way as you can show simulated hurricanes. That there's a lot of good resources out there, and that it's really critical to work on this last piece of the research part where we communicate our findings. And here, as you said, thinking about the audience and what the audience needs is really, really important. So next time you work on communicating your data, think about how you can visualize it and start working on it early, not by the time you get the data, but beforehand. That will help you to be prepared and have some nice visualizations. And from my experience, you usually get a lot of very, very good feedback on this type of work. So it's worth investing in that area. Thanks so much, Paolo.
Thanks, Alexander.
Awesome. I always love to have listeners of the podcast as guests as well.
Yeah, very impressive.
So you can give back to the community. Thanks so much.
I can't believe it. Bye, Alexander. Thanks a lot.
This show was created in association with PSI. Thanks to Rain who helps with the show in the background, and thank you for listening. You can find all the different topics we talked about in the show notes. Given that we talked about visualizations, there's lots of topics there and lots of further material. So head over to the show notes where you find all the stuff. You also find the link to the video. This is part of the video on demand content library of PSI, which I talked about in the intro. And this was a PSI webinar as well, which I also talked about in the intro. If you're becoming a PSI member, then you have access to all this material and much, much more. So tell your colleagues about it. There's lots of further great, great content. Reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients. Just be an effective statistician.